three on one. Bagley the step. Bagley with the dunk. And you can put it in the book and send it to the left.
There it is. Buddy Hield alone at the top of the Kings record book.
Oh, I like to see Fox Force 5 in an open court.
Fox into the lane. Oh, if you don't like that, you don't like Kings basketball.
Welcome back to another episode of the Kings Falls Podcast. My name is Brendan Nunez. Got Rich Ivanowski on here, as we always do. How are you doing, Rich?
The age-old question.
One day I'm not going to ask. I know it's a thing, but
don't
like,
you dare.
No, I keep thinking, how am I going to change this up? And then I'm like, no, I should probably stick to the same.
It's our lifeblood at this point. It's more entertaining than what the Kings are putting on the floor. Yeah, I'm fine. Whatever. None of this affects me anymore. Kings lost large to a very depleted Detroit Pistons team. The Pistons are not a good basketball team. You know, even at full strength, they're lucky to be in the playoff conversation. They're missing their three best players, really. They beat the Kings handily.
Yeah, embarrassing to say the least, and especially to go in there and really just not give any effort. I like to pretend that the game just ended after that Fox poster.
Yeah, that was fun. I saw you like live tweeting and being very positive, and
I'm trying, man.
Was encouraged by that, but then I was just like, oh man, this poor
you
guy.
You were nowhere to be found on Twitter.
I can't emerge. I emerged from the shadows, like in deep in the fourth, when I was certain it was an L to get my jabs in. Yeah, but there's issues. There's issues for this team. I put out a tweet about just how the Kings had a young 39-win team and $40 million in cap space, and they got way, way worse somehow, and that has over 1,000 likes right now. So, yeah, I think it's safe to say people are not happy with this team. I noticed that Grant Napier on his show had like some big emotional fan, whatever, said like, come ask your questions. You deserve this. You deserve to have your questions answered. He had Luke Walton on the show, and I didn't actually listen to it. Have you heard this? Did you hear this segment today?
Yeah, I somewhat know the guy. I didn't listen to the segment, but I have followed the guy on Twitter for a while, and he's always posting video clips of himself with reactions after every game. It's Nicholas Henkel, I believe it is. I've DM'd him a little bit back and forth asking some Pistons questions. But yeah, apparently he's always been a really big fan of Grant and enjoys listening to the broadcast. And yeah, Grant brought him on, I think, last year after the Buddy game winner. And both this year, he saw Nicholas's reactions after the game. And yesterday, even the Detroit fan was sitting there talking about how screwed up the Sacramento Kings were. He hardly talked about the Pistons, but it was just, man, what is going on with Sacramento?
Yeah, I saw that video. I think wasn't the show kind of did you hear his show? Because I heard that he was just taking callers and letting them really get it out, get their frustrations with the team out there.
I wish I had heard it, because I know they interviewed Luke.
Right. I don't know. I actually didn't listen to it. I apologize if I don't listen to enough of the Grant Napier show. I think that there's a lot of Kings content to absorb out there. I can't get to all, but it sounded like, from what I've heard, and I guess this is irresponsible to say, but from what I've heard, it was kind of pitched like that, and it was going to be a good chance for maybe Grant to be a little bit harsh on the organization. And I've heard that it just didn't come out like that, and it ended up being the same old platitudes, same old responses from Luke, same old defending of the team from Grant. And I did see a quote from him saying that, in his opinion, the Kings will not consider firing Luke Walton until at least the end of next season. So, and obviously that's not a fact or anything, but Grant is very, very plugged in with the Kings organization. So there's some weight you can put into that.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny. I had just pulled up that transcription from Kevin as well to read that off. But yeah, that was the quote that I had seen as well. And then I know that that Matt George just had James Hamm on the Locked On podcast, not today's episode, but yesterday's, and asked him the same sort of question. Do you think there's any chance that Luke's and Vlade's job is in jeopardy right now? Or is it more so you're looking at next season or even the next off season? And James Hamm said the same thing, that you're more so looking at the latter. Nothing too unexpected, but just kind of confirming what we had already thought to be the case.
Yeah, I don't know. I had thought at a certain point that I had started to think for a minute that maybe in the summer changes could be made. I do think that it's getting to a point where something might be done. I don't know. I've never seen a fan base this openly angry at their team's management. But then again, I mean, listen, we're not in Cleveland. I'm sure Browns fans have felt this way. I'm sure there's many other sports teams that have felt this way at times. I'm sure Kings fans have felt this way before, but just from the slice of fandom that I see, it's like pretty, pretty bad right now. And I think at a certain point, you know, we got to accept that teams are businesses and they'll do whatever is best for their bottom line. You know, Walton and Vlade make a lot of money, but at a certain point, if the fans turn on them, you know, and that affects the ticket sales, that affects season ticket holders, all that stuff, it will eventually, the math will even out and they would be gone if that scenario ever did occur. So I don't know. I feel like that was getting to be more of a possibility, but maybe it's just not. I mean, do you think that this team could just be this bad and frustrating for another year and a half and not have any repercussions in that way?
Oh man, that's a tough question, because I mean, really, we've said it a couple times, it kind of rides on the shoulders of Fox and Bagley. And I think we said it last episode before, I think Bagley specifically is like a 3-year project, and missing a lot of time this year makes that a little bit questionable. So I think that Vlade and Luke could both make the argument to Vivek that, you know, I mean, honestly, our time was not right now. Sure, we are definitely underperforming our current expectations, but I think that we're giving guys the right formula for what's going to make them successful long term. So I don't quite think, despite my crazy percentage I dropped early on in the year of Luke getting fired this year, I don't think it's all too likely. I'm leaning towards this same way that we've heard Grant say and James Hamm say, that it's going to take next season. If next season goes the same way as this year, then possibly. Because, I mean, they're also still paying Dave Yeager. I'm sure they don't want to be paying three head coaches.
Right. I agree with that last bit for sure. Although I don't agree with what you were saying before about it being on Fox and Bagley ultimately, because I don't really think – this is what we talked about in the last episode. You kind of – you said that it falls on Fox and Bagley to make this team good. There was like a pause in your sentence. And I said, I thought you were going to say it falls on Luke Walton to make them good. And that's still where I'm at, where I feel like Fox and Bagley have been a part of a successful, relatively successful team, certainly a more successful team than what's going on right now. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that they've been in the playoffs before, obviously, but they've been more successful than they are now under a different coaching style. And I think that that does hold some water. And what I'll say is that, you know, you said that Vlade and Walton can go to ownership and say, look, we've done the right things or whatever, whatever. I don't think it's about convincing ownership. I think it's about convincing fans. Like if the fans, do you agree with what I'm saying? Like if the fans turn on them and they don't put butts in seats, like that's eventually it's a business decision, right?
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I think rather than, you know, the wins right now being reliant on Fox and Bagley, more of what I meant was they could argue that, you know, we still have a bright future because these two guys are still on the roster, assuming that They don't get disgruntled themselves, which, I mean, if this keeps up, you wouldn't really blame them. But yes, totally understand what you're saying. I mean, Vivek seems to be at most games, and I'm sure that he hears the noise around, obviously, as the owner of the team. And like you're saying, I mean, season ticket holders start not renewing their tickets and such, then yes, it definitely does become a business decision. And I mean, yeah, the way it's looking right now, you know, lost 6 in a row, 15 of the last 18. And I mean, when you're losing to Minnesota without Cat, double overtime, New Orleans, Miami without Butler in overtime, you mentioned Detroit without probably their three best players and Drummond, Griffin, and Luke Kennard. And 8 of those losses being by 5 points or less is probably one of the most frustrating things. Like, a lot of these were winnable games. And the 3 wins they have of those 18 are against Phoenix, Golden State, and Phoenix has been terrible recently, and Memphis, that they was the only game that they won that was within a 5 points during that time stretch.
So as of this year, so I don't want to get off into the weeds about demanding that someone be fired, because I think that that is, for me personally, I think it's like, it's too far for me in any public forum to say that I think that anyone should lose their job without them doing something that is, like, you know, potentially harmful to another person. So, like, I think that I could give my opinions about how they're doing, and you can extrapolate from that. I don't want to, like, demand that anyone lose their job. I think that's just too far for, like, you know, a basketball fan or analyst or writer or reporter or any of that stuff. I think it's a little bit too far, unless you've got an overwhelming case, or it's something where, you know, hey, this person needs to be fired because they're putting people at risk or whatever, whatever. And that rarely ever happens in basketball. So, but I do want to ask, just because we can speak hypothetically, if you were predicting if management would make the decision to fire Luke Walton, what scenario would that happen in? Because I don't really see it happening this year. Do you think, because we've tried to predict what ownership may do in the past, and you did have a pretty high number for Walton in terms of a prediction at a certain point. Do you still have, is there any percent chance in your mind, if you had to guess what would happen, that Walton would be fired this year, and what would have to happen for that to occur?
Well, if Walton's fired, I think Vlade goes with him. They seem pretty connected to me. They both are on this 4-year deal that they had just signed. You know, Vlade had that promise that if the team's not better in 2 years, then I'll leave. And I guess having one up year kind of saved them here. But yeah, I don't know, because if the team just loses out from here, then you're looking at a really high draft pick. And I think that you could say, okay, we're just adding another piece to Fox and Bagley. So I don't know what it would take for it to happen this year. Maybe it would take one of the players going to an owner, like, mainly if you're talking Fox here, I think he's the main piece, Fox or potentially Bagley, going to an owner and say, hey, listen, I'm on the verge of not wanting to be here any longer. I don't see things trending in the right direction. I think it would take something from the players sparking and speaking out about it a little bit, and really just publicly being disgruntled, not necessarily publicly actually, but if they were going to ownership and saying that, then maybe that's a possibility. But yeah, I mean, I think if anything, it's probably next year. So I'll put it, I don't know, 5-10%. Like, I think it's just as likely that they make playoffs this year.
It's really interesting to bring up that scenario about a player going to management. I don't even think Bagley has the sway to do that, just because he's just
have his not, have his dad do it.
he's just not, like, played enough and played well enough yet to really hold that sway. But I do think that this franchise and this fan base kind of sees De'Aaron Fox as the team and the future and the hope for the team. And I think it'd be interesting if De'Aaron Fox went to ownership and said, hey, listen, it's me or the coach, or it's me or the, you know, whatever, and makes these demands behind closed doors in a professional way, just saying, matter of fact, like, listen, I, you know, my contract's ending in a year. I would prefer not to work with these people. And I may take actions to make that happen if you're not willing to accommodate me. I wonder, I do wonder if things would change. I think that is a really, it's a really sound hypothetical for like of what might cause that. But I've got another one for you. Let me just throw this out there and tell me how bad. So there's 10 games between today and the All-Star break. As you just noted, the Kings are 3-15 in their last 18 games. How many games, is there any number of games? What if they lose the next 10 games straight, just into the All-Star break? Then they've been 3-25 over the last 28 games. At that point, is Walton gone? Is Lotte gone? It may not necessarily. I think that you're more looking at a coach firing in that situation than a GM firing, and maybe that waits until summer or whatever. But I mean, at that point, if you're 3-28,
16 game losing streak at that point. If they lost the next 10.
At that point, don't you just fire the coach?
Probably, yeah. And I think part of a reason you could argue that it'd be a little easier is I think you have another head coach as your assistant in Igor Kokoskov.
Absolutely right. This is one thing I wanted to get here. I was going to say that firing a coach is rarely a good decision in mid-year. It rarely has ever worked out for anyone. It only kind of works in the sense that, like, it's a signifier to say, hey, we need to move on. We need to find a new identity. This year is done, because that's really what it means. This year is over. But it does make it easier to have Igor Kokoskov.
Yeah, it does. I know he didn't do amazingly in his time in Phoenix, but he was only given 1 year there, and he has experience being the head honcho. So yeah, I do think it does make it a little bit easier. But if the players truly are backing Luke the way that the organization presents it, then I don't know. If they lose 10 in a row, obviously they would kind of waver with how they're backing Luke here. But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting here, because they did not seem very happy with the way Jaeger was going about things. But part of the issue I see with, I wouldn't say the issue, but like Fox is we've said the leader of this team in regards to talent and his play out there. Like, he feels like the key piece. He is not comparing the players, but the importance and the way that they are the focal point of this team, he's the Steph Curry of the Sacramento Kings moving forward. But to me, they don't have a Draymond Green. And I think that they need someone that's going to call guys out on their shit. And I think that Jaeger was that guy last year. And
talking about Marvin Bagley's dad.
Right, Yogurt. Yeah. But I think that Jaeger was that guy last year, and it doesn't necessarily need to come from the coach. But when you go from a guy that is very strict to a quote-unquote player's coach that's going to be nicer to the guys, that, like, who is going to be the one to get these guys to play with the most amount of heart and just hustling and call them on their shit when they're clearly just lollygagging through things, you know? Like, I think that could come from a player as well.
So, I mean, are you putting that on De'Aaron?
No, I'm not. Because, like, my Steph comparison, I think Steph is the main guy on the Warriors, but that's just not his personality. And I'm not knocking De'Aaron because... And this is just me saying, obviously, what I've seen on the court. I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, if De'Aaron maybe is this guy. But it, like, sometimes you need someone to really not be afraid to get in your face and really tell you, yo, what the fuck are you doing? Like, get on your shit, pretty much.
Well, I have an issue with that analogy, because I would argue that only one team in the league has a Draymond Green, truly, and it's the Warriors.
Well, I don't think so. I think you could look at Marcus Smart. I think you could look at Patrick Beverley. I think that a lot of teams have that, actually.
I don't know. I mean, where I was going to go with the other half of that is that Draymond Green does it so much so that he, I think you could reasonably say, contributed to the Warriors losing one of the like best players in the game off their team. So, I mean, maybe him calling Kevin Durant a bitch like is a step too far, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right. Draymond's the most extreme example for sure.
I get what you're saying. And Pat Bev is an interesting example of that. I don't watch Marcus Smart off the court enough to know if he's in guys' faces, but I feel like there are successful teams that don't have someone who is straight up yelling at people. Like that leadership comes from coaching, that leadership, it comes from accountability in the locker room and all sorts of places. I don't know that, like, if I'm looking at the issues with the Kings franchise, I'm not like, oh man, they need a Draymond Green type to like scream in people's faces.
Yeah, I guess the screaming isn't the main part of it necessarily, but I think
I wish someone would call Marvin Bagley a bitch.
Like, right.
That's not what I'm looking for, not at all.
No, right. It doesn't have to be that way. A guy, I mean, I think of Shumpert last year, you know, a guy that really is going to keep the guys motivated and approach each guy in a different way. I mean, he's going to be able to realize there's some guys that if you are coming out and calling them a bitch, that's going to motivate them. Some guys you can't do that because it'll make them retreat into a shell and not want to interact with you. But I think that they really could use someone. And Shumpert was not a positive on the floor last year, but I think his impact in that we could tell in the locker room, giving the team an identity. You heard all the other players talking about him often as a guy that really would pump them up and get them going in the right direction, get the juices flowing a little bit. I think the Kings could use something like that.
So I wonder though, like the Kings spent all their cap space. They don't have any really real cap space going forward. They stood on bets. So, like, if one of them's not going to do it, if it's not Corey Joseph, if it's not Dwayne Dedman, it's not Trevor Ariza, we know that for a fact at this point. Like, what I just don't understand really is this is a fundamental flaw with the team, and they can't be good and they can't have accountability. What's the point here? What's the actionable? What can they do?
Yeah, I mean, somebody could step up and sort of become that, but I don't know. I think just I'm trying to figure out like what causes you to go out there and just completely flop effort-wise against like what we saw in that Detroit game pretty much.
Are you currently paying off student debt? Interested in improving your financial literacy or looking for new ways to earn income in today's ever-changing digital landscape? Well, on the Talk Money with Mesh Lakhani podcast, Mesh will follow paper trails, chat with experts, and break down complex ideas to bring clarity to the mystical financial phenomena. Each episode will be filled with compelling stories covering a broad range of subjects, from buying Bitcoin, dealing with student debt, and everything in between. Listen to Talk Money with Mesh Lakhani on Spotify or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts and learn how to spend, invest, and earn for today's economy.
So my theory, I think you have a good theory. I think your theory's got strong points. It's probably not it's not going to solve everything, obviously, but theory will. My theory, and maybe it's a blend of these two, but my theory is that it's an issue with game plan and approach and clarity of what each player is supposed to do. I think we've seen Buddy Hield become very confused with what his role is on this team. And it's because Walton demands that he guard Trae Young and then he benches him for not guarding Trae Young well, or, you know, so on and so forth. It seems like he's told to take, he's been said, you know, Buddy Hield is a neon green light. And then he takes a contested three. We agree, not a good shot, but then he's benched. And it's like, okay, well, it just seems that he's kind of the goalposts are moved for him in a way that he's become confused and he loses confidence in what his role is and, okay, do I need to do more? Do I need to do less? And it becomes confusing. And then I think Buddy Hield is one example of that, but it can go for more players as well. And like so often we just see this offense being stagnant and there's not enough going on. It just feels like the offense is flawed. And when the offense is flawed, guys want to do more and then they're doing too much. And then they don't know if they're supposed to be doing, if the one taking on the responsibility, then it's all on Barnes for like a quarter. Then it's all on this guy. It's like, it just, everything doesn't, there doesn't feel like there's a cohesive plan. And that to me is kind of where it stems from.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. And obviously, Buddy is the perfect example there. I definitely do put a lot of this on Walton. Don't get me wrong. I totally get where you're coming from there. But I think that there's times that player coaches work, you know, and but there's just not somebody to really hold these guys accountable, because there is times where the system is really the one that fails them. But there's other moments where I feel like some of the blame does need to go towards the players, like again, like that Pistons game. But yeah, I definitely can't deny that Luke has been confusing from an outsider's point of view with the quotes that he says and constantly just running in circles and making the same excuses over and over, injuries, reintegrating, trying to get them to learn new things that are going to work in the long run. Yeah, I definitely can't deny that Luke is a part of the problem as well. I just was, I guess, attempting to not say it's 100% on him, even though we saw this work last year with a different head coach in place.
Well, that's the confusing thing, it's the opposite. That's the one most clear thing, is that this group did do better under a different coach. And, you know, we can put whatever excuses we want, and some of them are valid. Some of them are valid to a degree. The injuries have been worse this year. You know, playing at a slower pace is going to expose more flaws for this team. Some of these are valid excuses to some degree. But at the end of the day, right, what matters to this organization is wins. And when you have the exact same group, because this is something that we maybe don't consider, this is the exact same group minus players that the organization chose not to retain. Like the guys that left this team, that was the king's choice. Like Willie Cauley-Stein is the biggest departure from last season.
This is a better roster to me.
And Iman Shumpert, those guys, the Kings chose, we don't want Iman Shumpert on this team anymore. We don't want Willie Cauley-Stein on this team anymore. Those were conscious decisions. And then they added players that you and I both know were good last year. You know, Ariza, you can kind of argue, but you and I both know that Corey Joseph was good last year. You and I both know that Dwayne Dedmon was good last year. We both know that Rashawn Holmes was good last year and is better this year. So it's the same group plus some, like you said. It's a better roster, and they've won significantly less games. At the end of the day, I think that means something. But I'll get off my theories and like our discussion of what could be going wrong, and I want to get into today. I want to talk, and again, hypothetically, because I'm not going to sit here and tell the Kings what they must do. I don't feel comfortable doing that in the position that I'm in. But what I'll ask you is, what would happen if the Kings decided to give up on this year and try to get better? It's tanking. The word is tanking. It's a dirty word, the T word. Let's talk about it, because let's say, I don't know if they need to lose all next 10 games for Luke Walton to be moved on from, but in my opinion, you can't tank in Luke Walton's first year. Or is what I'm saying? Let me back that up even further. What is tanking? Like, by your definition, what is tanking?
It's just pretty much saying we are playing for the future. That, you know, we're developing young talent with the understanding that that is not going to lead to wins right now. It's playing Justin James over Kent Bazemore or Trevor Ariza. It's playing Harry Giles over Anthony Tolliver, Dwayne Dedmon. It's playing your young guys and knowing that there is a very good possibility, and more than likely that means that you are losing games. And that also means that you're going to be getting a higher draft pick, obviously, come lottery time. I think that's a lot of what people associate tanking with, but a lot of it also is just getting reps for your young guys on the court. I think you see Atlanta doing it. They really went with, I guess you could say, like a tanking off season. I mean, if you look at their roster, when you're playing, when you're giving so many minutes to DeAndre Hunter, Cam Reddish, Trey Young, Kevin Herter, and John Collins, like that is your core, and they're all what, like 23 and under. I think that that is going to cause you to lose games. So to me, tanking really is just working on developing young talent. And I mean, it is revolving around that draft pick. If you have guys that are clearly causing you to just win, you know, seven games throughout the year, then you would ship them off, because that's going to lower your draft pick, but it's also not going to get you in the playoffs. And I think that's kind of why we're talking about this here, is because, say, Sacramento does kind of have a nice second half of the year, more than likely they're still not in the playoffs. And it just means that you just have an even worse draft pick. So if you're going to be in the lottery, if you're not completing for the playoffs and you're already going to be in the lottery, you almost want to optimize what you're going to get by getting the highest draft pick and some minutes to your younger guys here.
Yeah, I think that's a great, it's a perfect explanation of what tanking is. The reason I asked is that, and I knew you weren't going to say this, but I want people to understand that it's not intentionally losing games. No one does that. No one does that. No one tries to lose games. But
even if the front office is trying to, no player goes out there and tries to lose.
Well, even then, I don't even know if any front office tries to lose games. They just they deprioritize winning to the point where, like you said, play Justin James 30 minutes in a game and play Kent Bazemore zero, because right, he will be a part of your plans for the future, but the how much a player will help you win this year goes to zero. But it's not that you're sending your players onto the court saying, hey, lose this game. That will never happen. Like the even the GMs or whatever, no one will ever have machinations of like, I am trying to get this team to lose this specific game tonight. It's just thinking, it's moving when you want the wins from now, trying to win now into trying to win later. And the way you described it is perfect. I agree with all the points you made. And I guess my first question about it is, do you think this team can begin to tank with Luke Walton as the head coach?
Yes. I think that the offseason is really what put them in this weird situation, though. Like, they signed all these guys that are supposed to help you win right now. And most of these teams that you're talking about taking, I mentioned Atlanta. If you look at like New Orleans, I think pulling Zion yesterday is a good example of worrying about the future rather than wanting to win right away. It's a very short example. That's one specific game. I think they probably would have won if they kept Zion in, but they're worried about the future because that's when this team has potential. So I think that they could, and I mean, the way that they're going right now, they practically already are tanking. I mean, like I said, I think you could get more minutes towards Justin James and I would say Harry Giles, but he's more than likely not going to be part of the future of this team. But when you have Harrison Barnes, Bogdan Bogdanović, Buddy Hield, guys that you really want to be taking advantage of in the next 2-3 years. I mean, they're practically entering their primes. Harrison Barnes is in his prime at this point. That's what makes it difficult, is you don't have this entire young core. You have two young players.
So you said that they're practically tanking now, the Sacramento Kings. Do you really think that's true?
No, you're right. They're not, but I'm more so meant that if you look at where they are in the standings, it feels like they they're not tanking, because the way that I had explained it of focusing on the future, I don't quite think is their thought process. I know Luke has said that a bit, but no, we would see minutes to Justin James. We would have saw Wenyen Gabriel minutes. So it does not feel like they're intentionally doing this, but they do keep falling in the standings is all I meant by that.
Right. No, that's a good point. That's not even tanking. They're getting the worst of both worlds, where they're trying desperately to win and they're failing. And that's really a bad situation when you're playing Tolliver and Bazemore and, you know, I mean, guys that Tolliver isn't helping this team. He's not a part of this team's future. You can make an argument that the Kings may consider re-signing Bazemore at a small amount if they want to act as an over-the-cap team and find an offer that works. It's possible. But in terms of, like, the real future-facing decisions for this team, he's not part of it. Justin James should get more than 2 minutes if this team is quote-unquote tanking. And I don't know. I don't think that this team can tank with Luke Walton in charts. I don't think that there's a way to get him on board for that because Luke Walton is so into playing veterans and he's so into doing his thing, which is not particularly, like, I don't even know what his thing is.
It's so against what he says, that they're playing for the long term, but he's playing all these guys that are supposed to help right now.
Right. He gave Trevor Ariza 25 minutes a night, and then he says that they're, like, that's what's so frustrating about Walton is that nothing he says lines up with anything he does. Like, he will talk about pace, and then they'll play the opposite way of what he talked about regarding pace. Like, he'll say they're trying to play fast, and they play slow, so they're trying to play slow, and they'll play fast, and it's, he'll say that they're preaching defense, like, defense, and then they give up, they average, like, you know, 120 points per game scored against them. It's, none of it makes sense to me. He says that Buddy Hield is making huge strides as a defender, and then he's benching him for a bad defense. And it's like, I don't understand what's going on. But I don't think that Luke Walton would ever be down for that. I don't know that they could ever go to him and say, hey, listen, you're not playing Tolliver anymore. Like, sorry, he's 34 years old. He's not part of our future. You're not playing Tolliver anymore. I don't think they can go to him and say, hey, play Justin James 20 minutes a game because – we are trying to build for the future. I think that he desperately wants to win now, and he doesn't seem to be able to do that either. I don't know. I think that if this team were to truly tank, it means making some trades. It means prioritizing young guys, and I think that it probably would be easiest to do for the Kings under a new coach. I think I know it's going out on a limb, but I think that if the Kings were to go in full tank mode, they would promote Kokoschkov and let Walton go and say, it didn't work. It didn't work with Luke. And you're going to have to give us, you know, a season, maybe a season and a half to focus on the young guys. This time we promise that they'll actually get playing time. Then I think the Kings try to move Bielitsa. I think they, you know, try to move Joseph, honestly. Yeah, I mean, they may even at that point.
Was that next year you were talking about? Or this year?
This would be
at least. I know you're just kind of hypothetical here, but.
I mean, it's hypothetical, but I'm just thinking, like, in terms of the hypothetical of, like, if the Kings decided we are tanking and we this year is over for us, we need to look to the future, we need to be better in the future and not worry about now, then I think this move would make sense now if that's their goal.
Yeah. So the guy that is really interesting to me, if that is the case, is Rashawn Holmes. Because I think, obviously, Holmes has been phenomenal this year. I saw a funny tweet the other day. I wish I knew who it was so I could give credit of, there have been so many people saying, imagine what this team would be without Rashawn Holmes. And what do you know? They're the worst team in the NBA without him. But I think that we've said plenty of times that we don't feel like him and Bagley coexist and are able to optimize each other. And we've also said that Bagley is a pretty much the X factor of the future of this team. Does Rashawn Holmes get in the way of the development of Marvin Bagley?
I actually don't think that he does. And I think that Rashawn Holmes is young enough. And I think that you also want to have some decent players on a rebuilding team. We've seen teams that go too far into tanking where it may hinder their future development. The Hawks might be a case like that where they don't have enough on the floor to even really develop guys because, like, they can only get Trae Young so far until, like, okay, now Trae has to learn how to win, but he doesn't have the pieces to win. And then you're looking at, okay, well, you know, Alex Len is his center and there's not much behind that. And it's like, okay, well, now they want to add a center and now they're having to move backwards. They may need to surrender assets in order to get him enough pieces to continue to develop.
Yeah. And, you know, this would be very different if Memphis wasn't so hot recently. But what would you think of, say, like, you know, I mean, if you just wanted to get young, of the Memphis pick this year in exchange for Rashawn Holmes?
That is such an interesting question. Has someone brought this up to you, or have you seen it on Twitter?
No, I just thought of this today because the Celtics are the ones that own that pick. They have this hole at the center position, and Rashawn Holmes is a matchable salary.
Yeah, I'll say I don't want to call them out, so I don't know if they've brought it up publicly, but I have a buddy that's been messaging me this exact trade for a long time, has been discussing it with me and asking if they think the Celtics would trade Memphis's pick this season. It would be likely to convey this season. It is protected one through six.
Yeah.
But perhaps you have a better answer than I do. Do you think that the Celtics would do that?
I do, because they're very win now, and the amount of young guys that they have on their bench that really just aren't doing it for them. I think that the defensive steps that Holmes has taken this year is what makes that a yes for me, paired with Memphis overperforming expectations. I mean, they don't have any reason to be losing, and they clearly are going out there and playing that way. They're on a nice stretch right now, and the pick's not as good as they likely thought it was going to be. So I think that Boston would give it some really strong consideration. But Sacramento's point of view, I mean, Holmes is kind of this diamond in the rough that you found, and you're getting rid of Harry Giles, you're getting rid of Holmes. It's like, again, if we're going back to the argument of the fan base, does that come into consideration here as well when Holmes is like practically your best guy on the team this year?
Well, I'll stay with the Boston side of things for a minute, because I've been really adamant with this person. I'll have to message them after this and shout them out on Twitter and talk about it with them openly if they're willing to do so. But I've been very adamant that I don't think that Boston would do that. And to be fair, this conversation was had a couple of weeks ago when Memphis wasn't quite as hot as they are now. They've actually cooled off a little bit, losing the last couple of games. But,
yeah,
I mean, just a few weeks ago, Memphis was not in the 8 seed. They're actually not in the 8 seed anymore right now. San Antonio moved ahead of them. But, you know, Memphis was projected to be like a bottom 3 team this year. And I think that there's actually a decent chance that they regress a little bit. Like you said, they're playing above expectations. They're only 20-24. They're only, you know, a few games out of being a top 10 pick. And if they were to end up in the top 6, or, you know, just be in the lottery and move up in the lottery, which we just saw a team do last season, move up a lot in the lottery, then that pick becomes protected, and then it becomes a completely unprotected pick next season, which is a pretty big deal to have an unprotected first-round pick out there for a team that's really not expected to do, you know, big things during the regular season. Like, maybe they scrape by into the 8th seed, but I don't know. I mean, this pick could be, you know, easily could be the number 10 pick in the draft, right?
Yeah, I think that's kind of about where I would place it realistic, as like a realistic best almost. I mean, I think it could be a little bit higher. I mean, especially considering lottery odds, but I mean, 10th best odds here, because the bottom of the East, there's just going to be a lot of teams that they're not going to be worse than, you know. And then in this Western Conference, they're in this tier of San Antonio, Portland, Phoenix, and New Orleans. And I think that Phoenix is trending downwards, but those other teams could, they could pass them here. I don't know. I'm going to have to pitch it to some of my Celtics followers and kind of get their thoughts on this, but I would give it some pretty hard consideration, because I think that the massive hole that's at the center spot, as good as Daniel Tice has been for the Celtics this year, could be, if they feel like that is enough to get them in championship contention this year with the just parity throughout the league, then maybe that's enough, you know?
And I mean, do you feel that way? I mean, the Lakers are out there, right? The Clippers are out there, even though they're struggling a little bit. The Bucks are 39-6. Like, I don't know. It doesn't make them the favorite, right? Like, even say Rashawn Holmes in all his glory is his best self, I don't think it makes them any better than like a borderline, you know, top three team at bet. Like, it makes them maybe 3-5 in the league.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that when you get to, I remember hearing Daryl Morey, I think it was on the Woj pod last year, saying that once you reach the conference finals, I mean, anything can happen from there. So if they think it's enough to very comfortably put them, not very comfortably, but they feel like it will put them in that conference finals, which they're pretty close to, I mean, anything could happen from that point, you know? Like, if the Lakers are obviously a clear one, and I think they have guys that could slow LeBron, but no answer for Anthony Davis. And I think that Rashawn Holmes could help with that. I'm not saying necessarily that he is the lone answer to Anthony Davis at all, but it's a guy that is going to slow him down a lot more than anyone else they have on the roster. So I think that it's a unique situation because they have such a gaping hole at the center position and seem to really have everywhere else covered aside from maybe a little bit of a bench spark.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's really, maybe we're getting too far into a Celtics podcast right now, but I don't know that it really closes any gap between them where they are now and the likelihood of them getting into the Eastern Conference Finals. Like, they're already like pretty close to that line, right? Like, Miami's in the 2 spot, Toronto in the 3, Boston in the 4, but that's all separated within a couple of games. I don't know that Rashawn Holmes add to that team makes it like it's a no-brainer. It's the Bucks 1, Celtics 2. It still feels like they're going to have to play either Miami or Toronto, maybe Indiana, and beat that team. It doesn't make it necessarily. I guess my larger concern is, say you get the number 10 pick with that draft spot from Memphis, you can even say, if you want to, for purposes of making it more conservative, say it's the number 14 pick. Like, say that pick is, you know, or even 15, dead center in the first round. That's still a player that that has a lot of promise, even in a weak draft, has a lot of promise, and you get that player for 4 years cost controlled, and then the rights to, you know, you essentially get that player the first two contracts. Whereas Holmes, you get him for 1.5 years. And I don't think that the Celtics could resign him. And probably it's not going to put them in an advantageous position to resign him. If he breaks out and is truly great, they won't be able to resign him. And if he doesn't, then they wouldn't want to. I don't know. It just seems like a short-term for long-term thing there.
Part of what gets me, though, is that where do they find the minutes for this number 10 pick? He's more than likely not an impact guy right out the gates. I mean, you're looking at, like, they just picked Romeo Langford, number 14, and I guess he's slowly starting to work his way into the rotation, and he's a little bit more of a raw prospect. But, I mean, I just, the guy that they pick in this 10th, 14th spot, whatever, I don't see him getting much opportunity to develop. And they really are starting to become a win now team, even though they have some nice young talent around them. I mean, the two teams that I think Holmes helps with is the Bucks and the Lakers. Like I said, I think that he definitely helps you in regards to covering Giannis and Anthony Davis. And those are the two biggest worries to me to the Celtics.
Well, I think it's unfair to use Romeo Langford as an example because he's just been hurt and he's not been good and he's been in the G League. But if you look at players that were drafted around him, I mean, do you really think the Celtics would struggle to find minutes for Tyler Hero or PJ Washington?
No, Brandon Clark. Yeah, no, that's a good point.
And Matisse Thybulle. Like, you think they'd rather have Matisse Thybulle right now? He was picked number 20. Brandon Clark, like you said, like, there are, like, if they're a good player, they make a good pick, he's going to get minutes on the Celtics. I don't see an issue with that.
That's a good point. I think that's totally fair. And, you know, a difference between the Celtics and the Kings is that you do have a little bit more faith in the Celtics front office to make a successful pick at that spot.
That's definitely true. And the other argument I think is also, if it's not a home run for this season, then you kind of, it's kind of like the Spurs thing of like, you don't pay the guy, you just get the next one. And I'm not saying it's that easy to just sign the next Rashawn Holmes for a small contract. But again, like you just said, like the Celtics feel like they have a better chance of doing that than most teams. The center position is the easiest to get a bargain at, it feels these days. It feels like that's definitely the case. If you've got to get a role player in to a position, you probably want it to be center. There could be buyout candidates. It feels like they have the ability to add a center next season fairly easily, where you may not want to give up a potential top 10 pick.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, but all in all, I'm interested and intrigued and surprised that you brought it up as a possibility, because I had dismissed it out of hand and I feel foolish for doing so. But it's interesting. And yeah, I mean, I guess speak more towards the King side of it. I didn't really have any thoughts on that, just because I didn't think that offer would ever be made. But it sounds like you've got a take there.
The King's Pulse podcast is recorded and hosted on Anchor. It is the easiest way to make a podcast, and it is 100% free. It gives you everything you need to record, edit all of it so it sounds smooth and professional, and upload it all from your phone and or your computer. They distribute your podcast to every major platform. They give you an opportunity to make some money in the process as well. Download the Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
I think it would be kind of hard to not accept that from Sacramento's side. I mean, I would somewhat understand the argument of keeping Holmes with how successful he's been. And since there is not a lot of positives going for this team, I mean, you'd want to keep the couple of the lone bright spots around. But I mean, I think more than you do, it seems like I think that Holmes does slow down Bagley's development a little bit here. I think that Bagley is a five. And unless you're just fully putting Holmes in that backup role, but Bagley should be getting a lot of minutes if we're talking about going in this tanking route and really worried about the future, as Sacramento probably should be at this point. I think it'd be hard for Sacramento to turn that down.
Yeah, I think that Sacramento does take that offer, and I think they probably should take that offer if it's out there, because of all the things I just said, I do think that the, you know, whatever, 13th pick, 14th pick, 10th pick, even, you know, whatever, 15th pick even, all those are more valuable than a player that is on a very limited short-term contract. So, yeah, for all the reasons I stated, I think that would be beneficial to the Kings. However, I don't agree about Bagley, because you and I have both said that we see Rashawn Holmes' ultimate kind of position as being, you know, sixth man, you know, big man that comes in and wreaks havoc, causes havoc, you know, still plays 25 minutes a game or whatever. But Bagley apparently is a four, or, you know, at least that's how the team treats him. And there's still another 24 minutes at center. I feel like there's plenty of minutes for Bagley. You definitely start Bagley, sure.
Well, so, I mean, our comp for Holmes has always been Montrezl Harrell, right? And you're looking at right now, Harrell's playing 28 minutes. And I think part of the reason that Harrell works as this, like, super sub big is, I mean, Zubac is the guy that's ahead of him. Like, you don't worry about getting Zubac a ton of minutes, you know, and I think that Bagley is eventually going to be playing, you know, 30, 33 minutes a night. And then all of a sudden you're looking at 18, 15 minutes for Holmes there.
Right. But you also don't have Kawhi Leonard and Paul George taking up the 3-4 spots. Like, you know what I mean? That there's still far more minutes to go around.
You play them together a little bit, you're saying?
Well, sure. But like, you could also just play Bagley at the four. Like, you could give Bagley 36 minutes at the four. I mean, if we're really talking about a team that would decide to rebuild, then you try to move Nemanja maybe like what you brought up earlier last episode with the Tua Celtics for the 30th pick or something like that. You know, you move on from the 31-year-old guy, and you give Bagley as many minutes as his heart desires.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And actually mentioning the pneumonia thing too. I mean, maybe there's just a whole package where it's pneumonia and Holmes, and then you're looking at like a second rounder in the Memphis pick or something like that. That's really interesting that there is definitely some trade possibilities between these two teams. And since we're off in the deep end a little bit here, if you say that Holmes is out the door as well, how much do you start to consider, you know, I mean, there's this entire tier of this age range that we've said is part of the core before, but how much do you consider trying to see what you can get for Bogdanovich and Buddy Hield next year, or like a Harrison Barnes? I mean, if you're going fully young, you know, we've said, like, would you do like Matisse Thybulle and a top 20 protected Clippers pick from the Sixers? Like, do you just go all in at that point, you know?
So that's where I think that everything starts to spiral out of control, because it no longer becomes realistic. Like I said, personally, I would keep Rashawn Holmes. In terms of a rebuild, like you said, is he part of that rebuild? I say yes. That was my response originally. Then we talked about that offer, but that to me is like a outlier offer. Like if any player for the Kings is offered, if the Kings get any offer that is like an overwhelmingly obvious yes, then I'm going to take that, period. It doesn't matter if it's a rebuild or not. It doesn't matter if it's a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old, whatever. But in terms of a rebuild, like the focus or the intention of a rebuild, I would not have Holmes be part of that. I would have Corey Joseph and Nemanja Bjelica, as I mentioned, to be part of that. But I would not have Bogdanovich, Hield, or Holmes be part of that. I would not personally.
Okay. Yeah, I think I understand where you're coming from with that. I mean, they're not like so old that by the time that Fox and Bagley, and mainly Bagley, really just Bagley at this point, become very positive contributors, that they wouldn't be impact players themselves, they being Barnes, Hield, Bogdanovich. So yeah, I mean, you definitely can have your cake and eat it too in that sense.
And you just said it perfectly. Like, to me, that's what the point of a Sacramento Kings tank / retool / whatever would be about. Even retool isn't quite appropriate if you're keeping the same core. But if the Kings were to tank, the point of it is just that. It's to prioritize the window of Fox and Bagley. You can straight up go to those guys and say, listen, we're listening to offers on everyone else, but you guys are safe. You're the team, and we're going to purposefully try to move anyone that we think will lose value before you hit your peak potential. So it works for me where De'Aaron Fox, Marvin Bagley are 23 and you know, Barnes, Buddy and Bogey are 30. Like I think that's where you say, like, all right, this is our goal. When De'Aaron Fox is 22, 23, Marvin Bagley's 22, 23, these guys will just be turning 30. And that's the window. And we cap it there, 3 years. And if we can't get it by then, you know, we're all going to lose our jobs anyway. So that's the goal.
Yeah. And I mean, we're talking about this tanking and sort of optimizing your draft pick. If you're in the top here, what point do you, and I know this is a very weak draft and there's not like a consensus number one, and that kind of makes this difficult here. It's different if you're tanking for like a clear Zion, Anthony Davis, LeBron James level prospect, but this draft, from what I've heard, and again, we'll have someone on to dive into this at some point a little bit later, there's not a consensus number one, and there is a lot of variability, and feels like it's going to be a little bit of opinions of the front office. Is there a certain point where you're picking best player available, or do you really just look to kind of fill those holes that we've identified before of like a wing and a long-term front court pairing with Bagley?
I would say you just go best player available. And that's kind of the point of a tank is to add as much talent as you can and not really worry about the rest of it. Though I will just say, if you're comfortable with it, let's hold off on the draft stuff for a little bit longer. We're about an hour into recording tonight. I think we could do a whole another podcast on the types of players to sort of focus in on in the draft. But I would say, just as a rule of thumb, that you go best player available, and maybe that's the type of thinking that gets you a Luka Doncic type. I don't know.
Yeah, totally fair. Yeah, that was the only question I had on the draft stuff. Didn't even realize we were running about an hour here, but I guess that is going to do it, right? That's all you got for today. I don't think I have anything else for you.
Yeah, that's all I've got for today. I think we start to look at draft picks pretty soon. Maybe the Kings turn it around, go on a winning streak, and we can postpone that even further. But my thinking is that by the time the trade deadline expires in 2 weeks, then we get really deep into some draft coverage.
Yeah, and I'll say one final little quick note. I mean, we still have the trade deadline about 2 weeks out. Mark Stein's tweeting out that the Clippers are exploring the trade market for dependable size and says the Mavericks are in a similar position after, obviously, the Achilles injury to Dwight Powell. So definitely going to be keeping an eye on Deadman here.
I'm sorry, did you say dependable or independable? Undependable.
Looking for dependable size. Good point.
Sorry.
That took me a second. Yeah. No, that is a very good point. Who knows what he's viewed as? And I think that's kind of interesting is that, you know, I mean, are the Sacramento Kings having to, like, dump him almost as if he's this negative salary, or how are teams going to be viewing him?
I was so shook when Chris Kirchner told us that the Hawks would want draft compensation for Deadman. He said like Atlanta wants Dwayne Deadman, and then he's like, but they also want draft pick compensation. I was very shook, because if any team in the entire league would give up an asset for Dwayne Deadman, and I mean, I'm not talking like a big asset, I'm talking like, you know, the 50th pick in like a draft 5 years from now, like it would be Atlanta. I mean, like he could actually help them. They've got, you know, more money than they know what to do with. Dwayne Deadman was very good for them. He would help their team achieve some short-term goals, perhaps help Trae Young develop, like I was just talking about with their issues at center. It would be the Hawks if anyone were to give the Kings anything for Dwayne Deadman. It would be the Hawks. And to hear Kirchner say, nope, even the Hawks want something to take Deadman, that's rough, man. That is a rough state of affairs for a guy that we were so high on.
Yeah, I think it's a leverage thing, because, I mean, the Kings just don't hold any sort of leverage in this situation. They're clearly trying to get rid of Deadman, and that's the only scenario. It's not like, you know, we'll just play it out with them, we'll hold on to him, we don't mind keeping him. No, they clearly are dumping him at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. We don't need to get into this right now, but
yeah,
I mean, that's a horrific failure if you sign a guy for that contract and then give up assets to get rid of him. Like, that's, you can't use cap space less effectively than that. So I don't know. I almost would at that point just say, all right, we're going to hang on to him. We feel like we've got enough, you know, room to pay Bogey. We feel like we can, you know, do the stuff we need to do, and we'll move him in the offseason, or we'll, he can just sit here till he improves his attitude. I almost would do that. I almost would. I mean, if the Kings didn't have 100,000 second round picks and it wouldn't matter to them to move them, then I would consider that. But
no, you're right. It definitely would be a very big failure, especially considering this was our number one guy.
Spectacular failure. Spectacular failure.
Yeah, it'd be very Kings.
Very Kings. All right, well,
it's gonna do it.
That's gonna do it. Hashtag Kangs. I don't know what to do anymore. And I apologize if these podcasts have become excruciating to listen to. But this is where the Kings are at right now. And like always, I hope it improves, and I hope that we can give you some more positive coverage coming up soon.
Yeah. Well, thank you to everybody for listening to this episode of the King's Pulse podcast. Hear from us again in the next couple of days.